You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 20th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
And Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
We have a very intimate crew this week. Evan is still on vacation in Italy, and Jay has a business thing tonight. He may join us later in the show, maybe for science or fiction, but I wouldn't count on it. We do have a great interview coming up later in the show with Michael Marshall from the Merseyside Skeptics, but we're going to do the bulk of the show with just the three of us, guys.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So we got the A-team. Got the A-team for this episode.
Can't disagree with that.
Oh, did I say that out loud? Sorry. Bob, why don't you start us off with Forgotten Superheroes of Science?
Sure. This week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'll be talking about Mary Edwards, 1750 to 1815. She was among the very few women in the late 1700s to actually earn a living from scientific work. Edwards' husband, John, had taken on some work from the British Nautical Almanac for extra money for his family. His job among 34 other all-male human computers, as you know, back in years ago, a computer was actually a person who was doing computing. Their job was to study the moon and the sun and the planets at various times of the day and note as accurately as possible their positions in the sky. Now, these nautical almanacs were created every year, and they were used for, obviously, navigation at sea. And he did this from 1773 to 1784, the year he died. Now, Mary Edwards then wrote to the almanac people asking if she could continue the work to help support her family. Because as it turns out, after her husband's death, they lost the house that they lived in. They lost pretty much everything. The only thing she really got, or the family got, was debt, this massive debt. She was in dire straits. She asked if she could continue the work that he was doing. And at least according to some sources, the claim is that she actually did most of the calculations for her husband for all those years. It was really her that was doing
it. So she was doing it anyway.
Yeah, she was doing it anyway. And so I think it was hard to get a sense if they believed her or not. I mean, remember, we're talking the late 1700s here. But I think after taking on the work, it became kind of obvious. She was, over the years, she became known for her skill and her accuracy. And she actually took on double the work that her husband did, because this was really her main job, whereas he was doing this just for extra work. And I think she actually took on so much work that sometimes she was doing half the almanac herself. So she's doing a ton of work. And she was so good and so successful and was able to take on even extra work that after 6 or 7 years, she actually paid off all of her debt. So it went incredibly well for her. She trained her daughter as well. And together, these two Edwards women performed this vital role for like 55 years. They made these vital contributions to this almanac. So remember Mary Edwards. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing the obliquity of the ecliptic or perhaps ecliptic rectangular geocentric coordinates.
Got that on the first try.
Yes.
Yeah, nice.
Good job. All right, Kara, tell us about NASA's plans for an electric-powered plane.
I'm really excited about this news item. If you've been following any science news over the last few days, you probably saw that on Friday there was a press release that came out because NASA has decided that one of their new X planes is going to be dedicated to flying electric. And they actually announced this. Charles Bolden, the NASA administrator, announced this during his keynote speech on Friday at Aviation 2016. So the X planes are kind of special research planes that are assigned by the U.S. Air Force. And the first X plane came out in 1947. It was called the X-1. It was the first airplane ever to fly faster than the speed of sound. So, of course, NASA has broken a lot of records using these X planes. This would now be X-57. It probably wouldn't come out for a few more years. Yeah, it's they've made a lot. And they have a few other things sort of on the horizon, but specifically focusing on the X-57, which they are calling the Maxwell, which is named after James Clerk Maxwell, the Scottish physicist who did a lot of work in electromagnetism.
Oh, not Maxwell Smart?
No, not Maxwell Smart. on.
That would have been my first guess.
And loving it, Steve. That's where my mind went also.
I love that. And so it's actually like a weird looking little plane. It kind of looks like a Cessna. This is not a plane that they have any intention of flying cross country with. This is a plane that they do think could eventually be scaled for commercial flight, but they don't see it as being long haul. They see it more as being a commuter plane. And it's weird looking. It's like a little Cessna, and the wings are super skinny and really long. And the reason for that, as they say, is that the reason that wings are so broad on planes right now is that most of it's needed for lift. And so they're trying to overcome that, because the truth is those massive wings aren't really necessary to stay aloft. So once you're flying, the wings are actually really bulky and kind of overkill. So they wanted to figure out, how do you get this thing up in the air, and then how do you keep it up in the air? And the way that they want to do that is with 14 different electric motors. 12 are on sort of the leading edge of the wing, and those are going to help with takeoffs and landings. And then there's a larger motor on the end of the wing with a propeller that's going to help with a cruise altitude. And what they think that they're going to be able to cruise at, the cruise speed would max out probably around 175 miles per hour, which is actually pretty common cruise speed for private and commuter planes. It's not the first electric plane. I mean, make no mistake about that. There's actually an electric plane that's being flown right now, but its cruise speed is something like 40 miles an hour, which is probably not really that reasonable for commercial flight. The plane that's out right now also uses solar panels, which is pretty cool. It's not a NASA flight. It's actually called the Solar Impulse. And right now it actually is going around the world, but it cruises at around 30 to 40 miles per hour. Obviously, that is probably not that reasonable for commercial flight. But this NASA plane, which was taken from an Italian P2006T, that's right there where I'm showing you that I know nothing about planes, because somebody's going to write us and say, that's a P2006T. Come on. But they converted that plane. They actually took out the gas tanks. They took out everything that makes it a jet-powered aircraft, and they put in, or they're starting now to put in the incredibly heavy batteries and all of the components necessary to convert this to an electric aircraft. The interesting thing is, you know, what we gain from this. Obviously, the most basic is that the emissions go way down. The cost goes way down. The payload doesn't actually go down. It goes up, because these batteries are incredibly heavy and they take up a whole lot of space. So, you know, for example, 800 pounds of batteries mean that they had to take out the two rear passenger seats. They're going to have to take out the seat next to the pilot and fill it with instrumentation. So as of the first iteration of the X-57, there will only be room for a pilot and no passengers. Isn't really that viable.
But there's no fuel. There's no fuel.
And that's huge. And so not only are we talking about no emissions, we're talking about no sound. We're talking about, you know, nothing required in the refining process. And remember, jet fuel still has lead in it. It's incredibly dangerous. And so it's just way less toxic and way less of an expense to put this thing in the air. I mean, it could actually cut operational costs by 40%, and you could probably have these runways in places you couldn't have them before because of noise pollution. So that's really cool.
My first thought, I hadn't read this, and when I first saw this image of and this title of this article, my first thought was, I kind of thought that electric planes really weren't a good idea because of just the energy density of batteries just cannot do it. And so I'm wondering what the range is for this type of thing. And you said the top speed is 175, which is decent for some applications, but for a commercial, I mean, I wonder if they could really ever get up to a commercial plane using this technique using the energy density of battery technology today.
Well, they don't think they're ever going to be able to do a coast-to-coast flight using a plane similar to the X-57. They're saying with the design as it stands right now, they're going to be able to go 175 and they're going to be able to fly for about an hour, which actually is quite reasonable for many, many private and commuter flights. Now, that said, in the future, they hope to upgrade the 800 pounds of batteries to fuel cells, Once they can move up to fuel cells, then they're going to be able to overcome some of those issues. But I think it's a reasonable plan. You know, the same way I'm an early adopter. I'm excited to drive my electric car. I have friends. I know people who talk about it and they say, I'm just going to wait until the fuel cell. And then the fuel cell comes out and they say, I'm just going to wait till the next iteration, which is fine. But at some point you have to just do it. You know, and then you can start iterating after that. And I think that that's what's happening now. The other cool thing is that the X-Plane program has four other planes in the pipeline. This is an Obama administration initiative that he announced in February.
Cool.
And so they're putting a lot of money into this. They have four X-Plane projects in the pipeline. And during the press conference, the NASA administrator said that one of them is a supersonic airplane that won't generate supersonic booms. And it could potentially go around the world in 6 hours or go from Dubai to New York in a single hour.
I love X initiatives.
I know. It's so cool.
In an hour?
In an hour, I know. I mean, you know, it's funny because you see that we sometimes do take two steps forward, three steps back. You know, we have had incredibly fast planes in the past. They just weren't always, you know, completely safe. And it's hard. You have to weigh those things. And that's why I think these sort of experimental plane programs are important, because sometimes you do have to take risks in order to be able to move the entire field forward and get out of your comfort zone. But
yeah, and that's NASA's job.
Yeah, that is their job. I mean, commercial air travel is big. It's big business and a lot of people fly. So obviously you have to be concerned about keeping people safe. But the first step is to get something off the ground.
It's really, you know, like the idea of these electric planes, you know, prop mm-hmm. planes. It looks like we're like right barely at the edge of something that's usable. You know, obviously there's not a lot of room for passengers in this model, so that's not going to be very usable. So, but you could, I could say in 5 or 10 years, you know, when battery technology iterates a little bit, or mm-hmm. when fuel cells become practical, you know, these could be like hydrogen fuel cells might be a perfect application for this sort of thing. The idea of having an extremely quiet plane. Because you've flown these small commuter planes,
mm-hmm.
right?
You
book your ticket, you have a connection somewhere, and you realize, oh crap, I'm taking this tiny little commuter prop job on this one leg of the trip that I'm taking. And the worst thing about it is the noise. Mm-hmm. I don't mind the small plane. The only thing I really mind about is they're so freaking noisy. So I wonder how quiet the electric, you know, plane would be. You know,
I mean, they talk about it like it's the difference between driving a regular car and driving, you know, a hybrid. Like, it's quiet.
So probably this could fill a niche. You know, it obviously wouldn't be good for every application, but, you know, it definitely could fill a niche. And if any efficiency that we gain in terms of the price of, you know, getting from here to there, and also carbon emissions and all of that, could be huge, because it's such a big industry. So I'm glad that, you know, that they're moving in that direction. I just hope it all pans out. All right, guys, let's move on to the next item. So this comes up every now and then. In Massachusetts, the Senate just passed the Naturopathic Practice Act, which is a horrible piece of legislation that would give naturopaths not only licensure, but also a broad scope of practice. They could essentially function as primary care physicians. Like the first point of contact for a sick patient. So actually, we're going to be talking to Michael Marshall about the same kind of issues later in the show. But this is what happens is, you know, that, you know, naturopaths, just like chiropractors did back in the day, and now naturopaths and also homeopaths, acupuncturists, you know, there's professions that have a vested interest in passing laws in their favor. And it's not just getting licensure. It's in addition to getting licensure, it's also expanding their scope of practice, getting the ability to prescribe, forcing insurance companies to pay for their services. They're relentless at lobbying the government, you know, and in the U.S., that means all 50 states, you know, to get licensure and then to expand their scope of practice and to force coverage. And we often will fight these efforts. Like we've fought against Massachusetts licensing naturopaths every year it comes up. This is something that, you know, it's a battle we fought a dozen times, but we could win a dozen times and we lose once and then it's over, which is crazy. So, you know, once these things get in, it's a lot harder to get rid of them than to prevent them from getting passed in the first place. And then, so because of that, you know, the system is rigged so that it just ratchets its way up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we're losing ground, you know, one bit at a time, and all we're doing is slowing down the advance. We don't really have a way of reversing it or permanently stopping it, which is something we need to think about. Like, I don't know how we could. There just isn't a mechanism like to keep this from happening. We just have to fight each battle as it comes up and try to slow it down as much as possible. Maybe to give us enough time to educate the public, but you know, that's a massively uphill battle. So very quickly for background, naturopaths, you know, it's hard to put this gently. They're just, the whole profession is quackery. That's the bottom line. That they're based, you know, on this loose idea on the appeal to nature fallacy, that they practice natural medicine and, you know, they include nutrition and lifestyle things. But in practice, what they do is just an eclectic blend of every medical pseudoscience and quackery you can imagine. There really isn't any one cohesive philosophy there. It's just anything that's not science-based. Basically, a lot of what they do is homeopathy. You know, obviously, a lot of their training is homeopathy. A lot of their practice is homeopathy. That right there says, you know, that they're pseudoscientific, but also acupuncture. A lot of nutritional pseudoscience. I mean, they'll give like supplements for everything. A lot of herbalism. And then some of their own special nonsense, like their water cures, you know, that are just crazy nonsense. It's, you know, as a physician, I could tell you, because in there are lots of naturopaths in Connecticut. So I have tons of patients who will say, oh, yeah, and I saw a naturopath for this problem, and they did X. And X is always the craziest shit you could possibly imagine. I mean,
I could imagine some crazy shit.
No, it's always like, oh, my God. I don't even know what to say to the patient, because like it's like if I even start to talk about it, it'd be very hard, you know, because it would be embarrassing. And
yeah,
so I just have to be very careful about how I approach that. But like I had my favorite story. It's not a happy story. It's a very sad story, but I shouldn't say favorite. It's just very emblematic. I had a patient who was diagnosed with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I diagnosed him with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is the human version of mad cow disease. But prior to seeing me, he saw a naturopath, and the naturopath was treating him for months, during which time he failed to make the proper diagnosis. He had no idea what the guy had. He diagnosed him with magnetic hypersensitivity and then allergies to every kind of food you could imagine. So he systematically eliminated foods from this guy's diet. By the time the guy came to see me, he was on about 60 supplements, and he was thin as a rail. He had wasted away to nothing. And he actually died about a week after I diagnosed him.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. So first of all, the guy should have had the diagnosis 3 months earlier and could have planned, you know, the end of his life. He wasted the last 3 months of his life chasing this nonsense.
And spending money.
And spending a ton of money. And I'm sure that his profound malnutrition hastened his death. That is the standard in the naturopathic profession. That's what they do, is just utter nonsense. There is, in fact, no science-based standard of care. That's the problem. They are not physicians. They do not deserve to be healthcare providers. They are basically just quacks. Now, that sounds harsh, but I wouldn't say that. You know, I'm very, you know, even-keeled. I would not say something like that if I didn't think it was absolutely justified. But that doesn't mean there isn't a random naturopath out there somewhere who's like trying to practice whatever, science-based nutrition or whatever they're doing. But I defy you to find one. You know, their training is inherently pseudoscientific. On science-based medicine, we've been printing a series of articles by Britt Hermes, who is trained as a naturopath. She went through naturopathic education thinking it was natural medicine. And then by the time she finished, she realized that she had been swindled, that she had been taught a complete body of nonsense, that she wasn't even really trained. So she does an expose on naturopathic education. It was like, you don't get to actually see patients and they don't know how to diagnose stuff. I mean, they just don't know what they're doing. Not only are their treatments pseudoscience, they really don't have the training to even understand medicine and recognize and diagnose diseases, etc. So even when they say, oh, if we, you know, encounter a patient that's beyond our ability to diagnose and treat, we'll refer them to a physician, that's bullshit. They don't do that because they don't know how to recognize when they don't know how to recognize a diagnosis or when they don't know how to treat somebody. Yeah, like this guy was, you know, treating a patient with a very serious neurological condition for weeks and had no idea that he was utterly mismanaging Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. He probably didn't even know what it was. Can he diagnose him with this fake stuff like magnetic hypersensitivity or whatever? So this is happening. This is happening in the United States. is that naturopaths are relentlessly, state by state, lobbying to get, you know, licensure, and then to get the, to be able to practice like primary care doctors, to get insurance to cover them, to prescribe drugs, which goes against their philosophy, which is kind of weird. But again, they just want to be an alternate physician who doesn't have to actually, you know, spend time learning science, or, you know, they basically just want to be able to do whatever they want. You know, that's really what they want, is they want the ability to just do whatever they want without being held to any kind of standard. Because that's like work and stuff, you know, you have to actually study and keep up on
work and stuff.
What's the education program like? Or is it like really widely vary?
No, there's not that many schools, but I mean, it's just horrible. Like, they spend most of their time learning homeopathy and herbalism and acupuncture. And they learn some actual real stuff in there too, probably. But who cares? Because it's not science-based. There's no standard of care. So it doesn't matter what they spend their time doing. And then again, according to Britt Hermes, they, like, during their clinical rotations, they don't really get to see sick patients or treat patients or get supervised. So they come out of their 4 years of training.
4 years of nonsense.
So 4 years of nonsense. Yeah. First of all, they really don't have the experience to start practicing, but they do. They just get thrown in, they hang up a shingle, and they start seeing patients really without the experience. By comparison, for example, the minimal amount of training you need to get actually licensed as a family practitioner in medicine, you need 15,000 plus more hours of clinical training than what your average naturopath gets. It's a dramatic difference.
You could say that.
Yeah, they're just not prepared to start seeing patients.
Jeez.
But the other thing that's horrible is that once they're licensed, they basically regulate themselves. The states don't regulate them. There's no oversight. There's no external validity. It's just, okay, the naturopaths, then they decide what their own standard is. They get to regulate themselves, which is what they want. That's fine for a profession that has some kind of external validity, right? That holds itself to a demonstrable standard of some sort, but they don't. So it just becomes meaningless. And of course, the public interprets it as an imprimatur of legitimacy.
Yes, yes.
Like, I'm in a bad mood now.
Write your congressman. We do have to mobilize. We have to mobilize. Yes. We're talking about this. We do have, on this Society for Science-Based Medicine, a page to sort of aggregate legislative battles, you know, on alternative medicine. But we need a more automatic way of really mobilizing the skeptical community to just make phone calls and send emails, you know. That makes a huge difference, and we need to do a lot more.
A huge difference. Yeah, yeah. Never underestimate the power of just picking up the phone.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if everybody watched Last Week Tonight this week, John Oliver's show, and he talks a little bit about the gun lobby and about the NRA. Yeah. And of course, we talked about that on the show last week, and just how much we don't think about it, but these organized groups who literally will just call and call and call their representatives over, that's how they actually get these things passed. We like to say, oh, but they just have so much money. Money is power. I'm, you know, powerless against it. But the truth of the matter is they utilize that money to organize people, to actually make phone calls and to write letters. And when your congressperson has a stack of letters on their desk, or their phone is ringing off the hook by their own constituents saying they don't want this, they won't have the political will anymore to push it through, because they need their constituents to vote for them.
All right, Bob.
Yes, sir.
You talked a little bit last week about black holes and dark matter and promised to give us the whole story this week.
Yeah, this just really grabbed my attention. Astronomers are exploring the fascinating possibility that elusive dark matter may in fact be made of primordial black holes, and the recent detection of gravitational waves may be involved in this. But little background, we covered with great fanfare the LIGO detection that happened September 14th, 2015. Early in 2016, it came out that they, for the first time ever, detected gravitational waves and also direct evidence of black hole collisions. So that was really huge. We're watching the birth of an entire new field of astronomy, which doesn't happen very often. This discovery, as incredible as it is just by itself, may even be more awesomer than we think it was, because it may actually point to what the hell dark matter is, which is one of the biggest mysteries in astronomy. What is this stuff? We discovered it many, many years ago. We still have no idea exactly what this is. We're talking something that makes up 26% of the entire universe, as far as we know. And we're still not sure. People, the two big candidates for dark matter, have been wimps and machos. Yes, these are acronyms, not initialisms. These are acronyms. A wimp is a weakly interacting massive particle, which I think is the most favored theory for what dark matter is these days. This is just as I said, it's a exotic particle that has mass that we just have not detected. The other potential possibility for dark matter is what's called machos, massive compact halo objects, something like black holes or neutron stars or brown dwarfs or something like that. So if this theory or hypothesis is correct, we may tip the scales from wimps to machos. Now, primordial black holes, that's something that you may think you know what it is, but maybe not. They are theoretical. We have never detected, we think, any primordial black holes. The idea is that these types of black holes formed very soon after the Big Bang, and they're not caused by stars. It's not a collapsing star from a supernova. They think it's possibly caused by large chunks of gas essentially collapsing in on itself in the early universe. So these are not stellar black holes. They're not supermassive black holes. They're kind of in between. Their masses could be somewhere between, I don't know, I think 20 to 40 solar masses. We're not sure. So they're kind of like in the gray zone. So what's the connection then between the black holes and dark matter and gravitational waves? So what's going on? So the bottom line is that the black holes that collided, that ushered in the age of gravitational wave astronomy, we think they could have been these primordial black holes. And if they exist in the numbers that they could potentially exist in, that would be a lot of evidence, supporting evidence that this could be what dark matter is. So the reason why they made all these connections is because, a few years ago, astronomers discovered an excess of cosmic infrared and X-ray background radiation that they could not explain. So this isn't, you know, this is cosmic infrared and X-rays, not the cosmic microwave background radiation, which we've mentioned about a million times on the show. So the question is, where did this excess, very old, redshifted, and diffuse light come from? So the idea is that if the earliest stars that formed could explain some of this infrared, but not all of it. But the real clincher when talking about it from this angle was that if some of this gas that went into creating these very earliest stars also were sucked in by these primordial black holes, and not just the black holes, we're talking about lots of black holes creating what was called these halo objects, and these halo objects then would collect the regular matter that created stars and galaxies and clusters and everything. If this gas that created the first stars also went in, you know, were sucked into these primordial black holes, then that could heat up enough to create X-rays, this excess X-ray that I mentioned, and that's the cosmic X-ray background radiation, and that was a real clincher. So the fact that primordial black holes could explain both the excess infrared, cosmic infrared radiation, and the X-ray radiation that they can't account for, that kind of bound this theory, and it just everything made a lot more sense when you factor all these together. So that was one kind of line of evidence, that primordial black holes could explain this excess infrared and X-ray radiation that we're seeing from deep in space. The other way that this theory is supported is the black hole size. As I mentioned, the LIGO, you know, LIGO detected black holes that were 36 and 29 solar masses, which is kind of right around the sweet spot of what we potentially think that primordial black holes could be. And then there was another detection you may not even have heard this, but there was another detection of gravitational waves from two other colliding black holes. They weren't as massive as those, but they could kind of be considered within the range of primordial black holes as well. But so keep in mind that this is in the very early stages of developing the development of this theory or hypothesis. One of the researchers, Mark Kamienkowski, said, we are not proposing that this is dark matter. We're not going to bet the house. It's a plausibility argument. So that's where we are right now. So in the future, what they're going to need to do is they're going to have a lot more observations of black holes to determine if they actually are primordial or if they formed later in the universe's history. This would be awesome to if we finally knew what dark matter was. This is something that for how many years has it been since the late 90s, I think, mid 90s, since mm-hmm. they've been bandying that about. So it's such a huge, huge mystery. And that dark energy is still largely an unknown thing as well. So, but it's funny because part of me would be a little bit disappointed if it turns out to be these primordial black holes, because I don't know, there's something really fascinating about the possibility of some new exotic particle out there that is what comprises dark matter. But I mean, I would just be happy finally resolving that mystery. And it is kind of cool to think that there would be so many of these primordial black holes out there that it actually is what we've been calling dark matter.
Yeah, I think the whole thing is so interesting because, I mean, dark matter is just that. You know, astronomers discovered that there was more gravity in galaxies than we could account for by the stuff that we could see, the lighted stuff. So there must be some dark stuff, stuff that we can't see. That was it. It wasn't necessarily, the term dark matter wasn't invented to refer specifically to a new kind of matter. Mm-hmm. Just to refer to stuff we can't see. That's it.
Dark, yeah.
It's just dark. It could be ordinary matter that's not lit. That was always one of the strong possibilities. I think that was the initial assumption that
sure.
it was just ordinary matter. But then when we couldn't find it, some people started to think, well, maybe it's a new kind of matter. You know, it isn't ordinary matter. But this now, as you say, Bob, brings it back into, yeah, maybe there's just a lot of black holes out there that we didn't know about. But now we can detect them because of, you know, gravitational astronomy. By the way, Bob, is it gravity wave or gravitational wave?
Gravitational waves.
And what's a gravity wave?
Gravity waves happen in the ocean and like in the clouds.
Gravity waves are physical perturbations driven by the restoring forces of gravity in a planetary environment.
But like through a fluid medium, so like air or water. So you can actually see them and measure them, at not a gravitational perturbation of space-time.
Got it. Gravity wave is through a fluid medium. Gravitational
yeah.
wave through space is a
yeah.
quantum effect through space-time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So gravitational waves are ripples in space-time, whereas gravity waves are perturbations through a physical or like a liquid medium, like on a planet, in an environment like
Got
a planet.
It. Got so, it. Okay, cool.
Yeah, like you can actually measure. We've been able to measure gravity waves for many, many years.
Yeah. Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
But so the cool thing is now that we had a second detection already. We have already made a second detection a few months ago, earlier this year, of two other black holes merging. Two already, and because I think
so they may be crazy common.
If they are crazy common, then that would be a really solid evidence. And I think, you know, once they really start looking, and I think they're going to actually kind of loft a LIGO type probe or satellite out, you know, into orbit so that it's not disturbed by all the, you know, all the crazy stuff they had to do for LIGO to minimize all, even dogs walking outside, they had to account for in their measurements. If they could loft that into space, they would get even more sensitivity, and then we could potentially see a flood. And if they even if they make the ground-based ones even a little bit more sensitive, then we could still see a flood right. of these things. So that would be fascinating.
I'm always amazed when I read cosmology and I read sort of astrophysics. The way that science is done is in many ways different from the way that we have to do science in a lot of other fields now. But I think we used to be able to do science in that way, even in biology and kind of more macro chemistry, where there's a summation of something, you know, a summation of energy, a summation of gravity, whatever the case may be, that we can physically measure. And then something doesn't account for it. Like we have excess. And we go, where does this excess come from? How do I make my equations balance out? Why is the math wrong? And in digging through trying to correct the math, we actually start to discover fundamental principles. You know, we start to discover actual happenstance in the universe, which I just think it's so much harder to do that now.
Hello,
in
I heard that word.
Biology, for example. It's so much harder to do that now in macrochemistry and geology to be able to just look at the overall math and try and speculate or hypothesize as to what's missing. It's such a cool detective story that always fascinates me.
All right, Kara, what's the word this week?
The word this week is a fun one to say, and it was recommended by Blythe Nilsson from British Columbia. He says one of his favorite words is crepuscular. I love that word, too. Yeah.
It doesn't sound like what it is, though, but it is.
It does not. It sounds like some sort of like disease state or, you know, something you pop. Something
sounds
that
like a kind of rash. You have a very crepuscular rash.
Yes, like something with boils.
I think it sounds exactly.
Really?
Yes. I don't know.
I wonder if you came across the term crepuscular early on when you were reading. Because I think sometimes the earlier that words make their way into your consciousness, the more they truly carry that weight. So if you don't know what crepuscular means, because you've always thought it was some sort of hideous rash, its definition is straightforward, of relating to or resembling twilight. And specifically, we use it more in science as referring to animals or insects, organisms that are active during twilight or things that occur during twilight. So even though you can use it in general to, like in a literary sense, to relate to twilight, if you're writing poetry, you know, there could be a crepuscular, you know, feeling in the air. We saw a resurgence of this use more recently in the scientific literature. The figurative use did start way back in the 1660s, and around 1755, we started to see the use in the scientific literature. And it comes from basically an early Roman term that was used for twilight. It was creper, which meant dusky. And so crepusculum was the way that Roman writers would refer to the half light of the evening. So they were talking about right after the sun sets. It's the crepusculum portion of the evening. And then when right before the morning comes up, which is also a type of twilight, that was the dialiculum portion of the evening. And dialiculum completely died off. Like, we don't use that at all. But crepuscular did make its way back into the lexicon. So certain things that are crepuscular would include fireflies, which are actually beetles, not flies, moths, cats, and even rabbits. And also remember that there are some terms of crepuscular that don't relate to animals. For example, crepuscular rays are, you know how you look up and I always refer to it as a Jesus postcard? I'm like, wow, the sky really looks like a Jesus postcard. But the sun is setting, it's twilight. And basically the rays of the sun stand out against the unlit air around them. Those are referred to as crepuscular rays when you can really see those sun rays. It's a great word.
Yeah, it is. And that's, when I think of crepuscular, that's what I think of. I don't think of anything else except crepuscular rays. And they seem to radiate from a point. And it's just a perspective thing, like railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. And there's also the opposite of that is the anti-crepuscular rays, where they seem to converge on a point. And that's and that point is always opposite to the sun. And that's caused by the same thing. It's a perspective thing, and they're beautiful.
Yeah.
So you have nocturnal. Everyone knows that term, right? You mentioned diurnal is during
diurnal.
The day.
Mm-hmm.
Crepuscular is at twilight. What's matutinal? Did you say that one?
I didn't say matutinal. I didn't add matutinal.
Matutinal means getting up right before dawn.
Yeah, that's the other type of twilight. Yeah.
And vespertine.
Vespertine.
Wow.
In the evening. So like right after sunset. So yeah. So these are just all different specialized. Mainly to refer to when animals are active.
I think I'm quite crepuscular.
You think so?
I think so. I'm quite active.
I'm matutinal myself.
I am absolutely not matutinal. I am dead asleep during that portion.
No, I love waking up right before sunrise.
That's what? Like my worst nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, guys, let's go on with our interview. And for those of you who are premium members of the SGU, I will be simultaneously making available the uncut version of this interview, which is over 40 minutes long. So take a look for that in our premium content. Joining me now is Michael Marshall. Marsh, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And for those of you who don't know, Michael, who actually go, you go by the nickname Marsh, right?
I do. Just to confuse people, I go by a weird little nickname. So Marsh is what I'm tend to be known by.
Marsh is the vice president of the Merseyside Skeptic Society. He also is a member of the Good Thinking Society and helps run the conference QED, which is Europe's premier English-speaking skeptical conference. Marsh, you're joining us tonight to talk about some of the work that you have been doing with the Good Thinking Society regarding homeopathy in the UK. So why don't you give us the background on that?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating couple of years, really, because Good Thinking Society is a charity that was set up by Simon Singh, who I'm sure you've had on the show plenty of times,
yes,
and you know Simon
sure.
really well. So I'm kind of in the position where I'm a full-time skeptic working for the Good Thinking Society. It's my full-time job. And the idea of Good Thinking was, what happens if we've got a bit of time to take a look at things with a pragmatic approach, a kind of a professional approach, really try and figure out what's going on. And one of the things we really started to focus on first was the fact that homeopathy is supplied on the National Health Service here in the UK. So actually our healthcare, our Medicare kind of thing is funding homeopathy. And what really shocked me when I first started looking into this is there was nobody in this country who knew how much money we were spending on homeopathy, how much of taxpayers' money was going on stuff that we all knew didn't work at all, because there was nobody involved in the health service whose job it was to sign that check or to ask the figures. So we had this kind of initial starting point where we had to figure out ask every different part of the country individually in these 200 and something different health boards whether they funded homeopathy and how much, and then we had to put those figures together. And so we're in this weird position where we as a charity were the first people in the country to know actually how much money the country spends on homeopathy and where it's being spent. And it's between sort of 4 and 5 million is the figure we came up with when we did it a year and a bit ago. Which is a ridiculous amount. I mean, it's not a huge amount in terms of a whole country's budget for healthcare, which is going to run into the billions. But when you look at it in terms of, you know, nurses and recently junior doctors here in the UK were on strike because their pay was being cut, that £5 million starts to look like it's money that could be spent in better places than on sugar pills that we know don't actually do anything. Yeah. So what we then started doing is once we knew where all the money was being spent, we started looking at, which health boards were making the decisions to fund it and whether those decisions were being made lawfully, actually following the correct due process for spending public money. And we got a bit of legal advice from some solicitors who helped us put together a case against Liverpool, where I live, who were spending something like £30,000 on homeopathy. They've made a decision to carry on funding it, and we managed to challenge that decision. We've been really fighting that case and advocating for ending homeopathy in Liverpool for about 18 months. And as of last week, homeopathy was dropped from Liverpool healthcare completely. They've stopped funding it as a result of our work, which was a phenomenal win, really. It was a really great moment for us as a charity and the work we've been doing, really.
Yeah, that is awesome. How much did they spend in legal fees defending their decision, I wonder, to spend £3,000?
I'm not sure, but I mean, to be honest, it's one of the points that one of the solicitors who was working with us was pointing out is that we first of all asked the Department of Health, who's in charge of all of the country, to issue guidance to say stop funding homeopathy. Because you guys remember there was the big evidence check in 2010 that looked at all the evidence and said, look, we've got to stop funding this. But the way the government responded to that was to say, well, we don't disagree with the findings, but we're not going to tell each of these different health bodies how to do their job. They've got to do that themselves. So we said to the Department of Health, you should really issue guidance and tell them to stop, because it's spending a lot of money that they don't need to spend. So part of our point was, if the Department of Health had actually listened to us, then we wouldn't have had to bring this kind of legal case. They wouldn't have had to spend legal fees and then go through a long consultation. And this is something that's now happening all around the country in the various different areas that are funding homeopathy. They're now going through the same kind of review, the same kind of consultation. And luckily, because we're aware of where it was being funded, we're aware of the decisions to fund it, we're also aware of the reviews, and we can actually be part of those reviews. And that was really the real success in Liverpool, was not only challenging their decision to get them to go to a review, but was to then actually to work with the Merseyside Skeptics, who I'm also vice president of, to mobilize skeptics in Liverpool to start being part of the consultation. Because what always happens, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, is that when these kinds of decisions come up, the homeopaths hear all about it because it's their patients that are being denied the treatment that they think is going to work. And, you know, we know it doesn't really do anything, but they really do firmly believe it works. So they corral their patients to get involved, but nobody corrals skeptics to get involved. And if skeptics even hear about it, we kind of say, oh, Liverpool's going to start reviewing homeopathy. Great, they should get rid of it. And we might put a note on Twitter or put a note on Facebook. But we won't say to Liverpool, well, you should get rid of it and here's why. So one of the things we were able to do was actually write to people in the Liverpool area and even wider and say, you need to put your voice into this consultation, because otherwise they're going to get hundreds of responses from people saying we need to keep homeopathy and nothing from people saying we need to get rid of it. And although this isn't going to be a vote, it's not going to be taken on purely populist opinion. It's going to be taken on the evidence. But if they have the evidence on one side and 200 people saying we need to keep it on the other side, it's really hard for them to make the decision to cut it. Whereas if they get 300 people saying it doesn't work and 300 people saying it does work and the evidence says it doesn't work, it's really easy for them to cut it. So that was really the heart of what we did, is this kind of, first of all, this initial challenge, but then actually speaking to local skeptics and lobbying them and trying to corral them and motivate them and make them all enthusiastic to get involved. And in the end, I think it was something like 700 responses joined in the consultation, and about 450 to 500 of them were skeptical voices saying there are better ways to spend this money. There's better things that this money can be spent on, which was really significant that we actually had more of a say. And I think it was 75% of respondents said they wouldn't use homeopathy and 73% said it shouldn't be funded, which was astonishing to us, really. And it really did make a huge contribution to what was a great victory, really.
I've always considered homeopathy to be the lowest hanging fruit because it is 100% magic pseudoscience. There is, and it's well studied pseudoscience. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of studies showing that homeopathy does not work. It cannot work. It does not work. It's pure nonsense. If we can't get rid of homeopathy, then we can't get rid of anything, you know? So yeah. I do think we need to keep the pressure up. And I think you guys are doing a great job. In the UK, I think they're doing a great job. We're doing everything we can in the US. I think we're making some strides in terms of multiple organizations now, like the Evidence Check out of the UK, reviewed the evidence. Basically, they concluded that homeopathy was witchcraft.
And the Australian one was fantastic too. The NHMRC, absolutely fantastic report.
Yeah, it works for nothing. It doesn't work for anything. So we have the science and the evidence on our side. We have the logic on our side. It's not cost effective because it doesn't work. It's a waste of money. We have every argument on our side. It's amazing how it's so hard to make headway when everything factually and every argument seems to be pointing in our direction.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although I do think part of the opposition is, even within the skeptics movement, we can fall victim to saying, well, it's a placebo effect, so it can't really be that bad. Shouldn't we allow homeopathy as a placebo effect? That comes up. I do quite a number of talks specifically on homeopathy and the work we've been doing, and that always comes up from a skeptical audience. And it always strikes me that the response to that comes to mind is that while we know homeopathy is a placebo, not all placebos have to be homeopathy. And if we're going to give out the placebo give a patient a placebo, and there's lots of kind of ethical questions about whether that's even a good idea. But even if we accept it, it's a good idea to give a patient a placebo. Can we not choose a placebo that at the end of the street, the guy's going to say, we'll cure your cancer? Can we pick a different placebo that doesn't have two centuries of baggage of people saying it really does work? So I think that's kind of part of it, is that we need to kind of divorce this idea that homeopathy being a placebo can't be harmful, because we as a charity get contacted by people more regular than I'd like. Where they say, one particular case always come to mind of a lady who said her mum had breast cancer with a 90% chance of 10-year survival. And she was convinced to try homeopathy instead of conventional medicine. And then she was convinced to do naturopathy and this type of enema and have her mercury fillings removed and put black salve on. And the lady died within 3 years. And it's an utterly tragic case. That's a complete waste of a life. It's such an utter tragedy. That's so avoidable. And part of that avoidability, I think, is that we allow, some of us can allow homeopathy a free pass because it's just a placebo and it can't harm people. But when you see the harm there, it's staggering.
Yeah, I totally agree. That is, in my experience, the most common argument that comes up on the other side, even from scientists, even from skeptics. It's like, well, you get a placebo effect, and that's something, right? Because it makes people feel better. But that's why I've written extensively about, the rise and fall of placebo medicine. It's interesting that, 20 years ago, when the proponents of homeopathy and acupuncture and all these alternative methods were arguing, which were promoting themselves, they're saying, oh, we just haven't been researched. It's not fair. The people, we're not getting the research money like Big Pharma is. Just do the studies and we'll show that it works. So we did the studies. We spent billions of dollars. We researched all these things and they don't work. Now they're saying, well, okay, they're no better than placebo, but placebos work too. You know, placebos are fine. So they've totally changed their argument, you know, to support the thing they're going to support no matter what the evidence says. But the placebo argument just falls flat if you look at it even a little bit. As you say, once you get in their office, they'll tell you that it will cure your cancer, you know. So it's bullshit. They're not honest. They're not even being. They're not saying, hey, this is just a feel good placebo. Don't use it to treat anything real. This is just going to make your subjective symptoms feel better. They're absolutely not saying that. They're saying that this is real medicine that affects your body, and that through all their bullshit hand waving vitalism arguments, that it has a real physical effect. That's what they say. And as long as that's their position. It's completely disingenuous to then try to dismiss all of the evidence showing that it doesn't work as, well, there's a placebo effect and that's good too. 'Cause that contradicts everything else they say about their treatment.
Well, I think that's true. And I think the real dangerous thing is that I don't think I've ever spoken to a homeopath who I think was knowingly conning people. I think they utterly, completely believe what they're doing. And you know, I think most homeopaths, if not all, come from a position of compassion and a want to care, but they've got all the wrong answers. And the really dangerous thing about that is once you've got all the wrong answers, but a cast iron certainty that you can help, you don't know the limitations. And that's where you do lead people into all sorts of really, really damaging health decisions. Because why wouldn't you treat their cancer? You've got the single alternative, just a valid alternative to conventional medicine. Why wouldn't you use it? This is the system of medicine that's good for everything. So yeah, that certainty is just as dangerous, or even arguably more dangerous than somebody who went in knowingly trying to con people.
Sure.
I think homeopaths are utterly certain about things.
But there's also, I think, a level of hubris involved that just goes beyond the pale. Like when you think about, obviously, the vast majority of homeopaths are not licensed physicians. There may be some like incredibly small percentage of,
it's like 3%.
Who like went through medical school and like still kind of subscribe to that. But the vast majority of homeopaths basically wanted to be doctors, but didn't want to do all the work. You know what I mean? Like there is that component to it.
Well, most, at least in the U.S., I'm not sure if the U.K. numbers, most people who are prescribing homeopathy are either chiropractors or naturopaths. The very few are just homeopaths. You know what I mean?
Oh, and I think in the U.K., it's mostly just homeopaths. But
yeah. Interesting.
The interesting thing is that the majority of homeopathic remedies that are on sale in the lay public are actually not lawfully able to be sold because they don't have a license. So literally overwhelming majority of homeopathic remedies are essentially, if you want to sell a medicine and homeopathy would count as a medicine because it's claiming to do something to your body, you have to have a license under the EU law. And as of time of recording, the UK still falls under EU law. As of time of the show going out, I don't know if that's going to be true. I'm really crossing my fingers that it's still going to hold. If you want to sell something, it has to be covered by an EU license. And there's actually not that many homeopathic remedies that have an EU license. And if you're going to sell something that doesn't have a license, you have to sell some. You have to be a doctor with prescribing privileges and having actually seen patients. And this is one of the things that I did working for Good Thinking, is that there's a homeopathic pharmacy based up in Glasgow that supplies the homeopathic hospital in Glasgow. And on their website, they've got a list of just the most bonkers things you could imagine. 3,000 different homeopathic products, things like homeopathic anaconda and homeopathic rainbow and homeopathic color blue. Just the color blue. I don't know why you'd buy the color blue by itself when you can buy the rainbow and get the color blue in it like a multivitamin. I don't know why you'd buy the individual colors. And they've got homeopathic Lourdes water, so water from the Lourdes sanctuary in France, which I love because the idea of that is that the Lourdes water is blessed by God to be able to cure all illnesses. But sometimes you need something a bit stronger than blessed by God. So you dilute it down to make it homeopathic. I don't know.
Well, I also love that they're diluting water into water, which is like, I don't even understand that.
It's incredible. But one of the things I noticed they were selling was homeopathic owl. And I phoned them up and I actually recorded this and we published it in a newspaper, the video that I made from the phone call. And I asked them, what does homeopathic owl treat? Is it for people who are allergic to owls? And they said, well, it can be, but it's mainly for people who have taken on the characteristics of an owl. And I said, what does that mean?
And they said,
well, you know, they can't sleep well at night. And there was a pause. And they said, because people can take on the characteristics of animals. And I thought, hang on, are all the characteristics of an owl not being able to sleep at night? because that's called insomnia. We've got a word for that, and it's not becoming an owl. But I ordered that remedy. They sent me some homeopathic owl through the post, and it's unlawful. There's no license for it. And this is a pharmacy that is supplying our National Health Service. As far as we can tell from the contract you've looked at, they're making more than £100,000 of taxpayers' money, and they've got no license to be selling that over the phone. So that's one of the other areas that we as Good Thinking have been looking into, is getting the regulators, the MHRA, who are the people who regulate unlicensed medicines, to really take a look at this. Because so many, the overwhelming majority of homeopathic remedies you buy in the UK are not licensed and therefore not lawful for sale.
But that it also brings up a good point with homeopathy. One of the best weapons against it is just education, because most people don't know what it is. It's more ridiculous than most skeptics even know. The deeper you dive on it, the more you realize how batshit crazy it is. Like, as you say, like homeopathic owl. I mean, you know, it's just, it is just rainbows. It's nonsense. And their approach to the patient is real, is witchcraft. It is witchcraft. Mm. They consider things like, do you cry when you hear piano playing? And that somehow tells me something about the overall, you know, illness that you have. And it's just ridiculous. I did want to get back to another thing that you were saying about, you were talking about placebo medicine. But the point that I think that you're making is that the process is more important, if anything, than just this one manifestation of homeopathy. Even if homeopathy itself, because it's diluted and there's no active ingredient, is not directly harmful, the real problem is that the people selling it are not doing it right. They're not doing due diligence. They're not being science-based or evidence-based or logic-based. They're practicing magic based upon their own hubris. I think that's right, Kara. And I've spoken to, like, in naturopaths who prescribe homeopathy, and I said, okay, well, despite all the negative evidence, why do you continue to prescribe this? And their answer is, because I've seen it work. I've seen it work, so that's good enough for me. Mm. Well, wow. That's the problem.
It's powerful.
Not, yeah. More than the homeopathy, the fact that you think you can decide what works and what doesn't work based upon your own anecdotal observation, that's a much deeper problem than this one quack manifestation of it. And I try to convince, you know, communicate that to people as well. You need a science-based standard of care. If you don't have that, there is no end of the mischief that you will create.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And you know, you think of the hubris. There's a group called Homeopaths Without Borders. And if you guys know about them, they go conflict zones and natural disasters. And I always point out that they're not Médecins Sans Frontières. They're Médecins Sans Medicine.
Yeah.
But they get straight on a plane. They go to these places. And with those people, it's hard because I kind of, from the one side, what they're doing is terrible. You know, they're turning up to disaster zones with, you know, suitcases filled with sugar pills, presumably, that aren't going to do anything at all. And you kind of want to obviously look at that and condemn it. But from the compassionate side of the skepticism I bring is, you kind of look at it and say, well, separate their action from their intent, because their intent is, I've just seen a natural disaster. I need to get on the first plane there to help. That's an amazing intent, but they've got all the wrong answers, and all they do is turn up and essentially waste people's time. And or, you know, they really can't help people. They can't. They haven't got the training, the skills, the understanding, or, you know, as you say, the science-based medicine background to actually be able to offer any real help.
They're not just wasting people's time. They're undoing the work that so many legitimate physicians are doing, going into conflict zones where, you know, oftentimes European white doctors aren't trusted already, and trying to gain the confidence of the community. These individuals coming in and basically doing bullshit medicine, and the people don't get better, or the people could die, is just going to crumble what little confidence is already there. It's actually quite dangerous.
And they're not just treating symptoms. They're like treating AIDS. They think that you could treat AIDS with homeopathy or use homeopathic vaccines against real illnesses. That's dangerous shit right there.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I've been sold homeopathic malaria vaccine, I think, 4 or 5 times in the last year. It's one of the things I do when I sort of visit new towns to give a skeptics and pub talk, is try and pop by the local homeopathic pharmacy or health food shop and ask them what they can give me for malaria. And I was in one particular shop, really busy, popular high street shop, so not like a little backwater place, a really kind of prominent place. And they told me that if you take a malaria Norsod and you don't have malaria, you might start manifesting the symptoms of malaria, because you'll start proving the remedy and showing that what the remedy is meant to cure. So she said the best thing to do might be to wait until you go away And if you do contract something, then come back and see a homeopath. So her advice is go and get malaria. And if you get malaria, come back and a homeopath will solve it. And the thing that really gets me, obviously that's incredibly dangerous advice, possibly the worst advice you could probably get, but she'd consider herself a holistic person, a holistic treatment there. But her advice is go away, either take this pill and go away, or go away and come back and take this pill. Whereas if you see a doctor and you're worried about catching malaria, they'll say, well, here's an anti-malarial pill and here's a mosquito net and here's some mosquito repellent and here's some advice about how to cover up and not, you know, during the peak times.
Right.
That's real holistic advice. And it's the doctor who's giving holistic advice. In this case, the homeopath who's just saying this pill will is what will cure you. But yeah, it's the worst possible advice you could give. And it's not rare that I've been given that advice. And it's actually 10 years since Simon, head of Good Thinking, was working with Sense About Science and BBC Newsnight, a real kind of highbrow investigative program. And they sent a student into 10 different homeopaths to say, I'm going off to West Africa. I'm very worried about catching malaria. Can homeopathy help? And 10 out of 10 homeopaths gave them something. And here we are, 10 years later, I'm going into homeopaths and they're given exactly the same stuff. There's no changes, there's no system getting better, there's no regulators kicking in to sort of weed out errant behavior in homeopaths as far as we can see. They're still making the same claims they were. And that, to me, is a sign that this is not a legitimate, respectable industry necessarily. Because if there's a doctor who's making really crazy claims, other doctors will say, this guy is saying stuff that he should not be saying, he's doing stuff he should not be doing. I don't think I've ever heard a homeopath criticize another homeopath for their for their actions.
Yeah.
Never heard it, I don't think.
All right. Well, Marsh, thank you so much for joining us. So, hey, you're doing QED in October this year.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just before we move on to QED, I would say that if anybody wants to check out what we're doing at the Good Thinking Society around homeopathy, they can go to goodthinkingsociety.org. And we are a charity. And if anybody wants to kick in some money to keep us going, they can go to goodthinkingsociety.org/donate. And we do kind of survive on that kind of stuff. So if anyone thinks the work we're doing is worthwhile, you can always go and support us there. But yeah, so I'm also doing QED in October this year. And Cara, you're going to be coming along and speaking at that, aren't you?
I am. I'm so excited.
It's going to be fantastic. We've got lots of great speakers, and hopefully there's going to be about 600 people there. And yeah, it's there's still a lot of work to do for it. And I think the next how many more months of my life are going to be taken up with it. But we're hugely looking forward to it.
Awesome. All right, Marsh, thanks for joining us.
Absolute pleasure, guys.
Thanks, Marsh.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And we have a special theme this week I picked just for the two of you. Hmm. That theme is new species discovered in 2015.
Oh, crap.
This is something I've done before.
Yes, you have.
I try to mix up when I spring it on you so it's not predictable. But yeah, and there's four items.
There's only
two of you, so I figured you have time to go through four items.
Thank you so
much. Yeah, it's better. Better odds.
Better odds for me, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so three of these are actual species discovered discovered this in 2015. One of them, there's something hinky about it. See if you can sniff it out. Here we go. Item number one, scientists have named a new species of peacock spider, Meridus jactatus, so named because it extends a semicircle of brightly colored hairs on its back during mating displays. Item number two, scientists discovered a fish, Torquagenor albomaculosus, that explains a 20-year-old mystery, the origin of what was dubbed crop circles of the sea, intricate circles built by the male fish as a nest. Item number three, Limonectus larvipartus is the only known species out of 6,455 frog species that give birth to live tadpoles. And item number four, the ninja lantern shark, Edmopterus benchley, is all black, but also glows in the dark. Kara, go first.
I'm going to go through them in order. Peacock spider, jactatus, Meridus jactatus. I like that. Seems reasonable. Peacock spider, it's peacocking, it's got bright hair, it's some sort of mating ritual. I like it. Torquagenor albomaculosis. Crop circles of the sea. I kind of get it. I mean, I don't love it, but I think maculosa, something, I think that has to do with spots. So it kind of makes sense. Circles, spots. Limnonectus larvipartus, only known species of 6,455 frog species that give birth to live tadpoles. Oh, instead of eggs, I see. That would be bold. Seems not reasonable, but maybe. And the ninja lantern shark, Etmopterus benchley. That's a weird name. It's all black, but also glows in the dark. Well, that's not that hard to do if you have bacteria, like bioluminescent bacteria in a pocket somewhere. I don't like it. Steve, I don't like it. The most obvious to me would be the frog that gives birth to live tadpoles out of over, you know, nearly 6,500 species. It seems like that is a fluke. Usually when there's something like that's a statistical error, you know what I mean? So that one sticks out to me the most. But then I'm worried that that means it's the most obviously science and that the one that seems least obvious is probably fiction, which would be to me the peacock spider. But I'm going to go with my gut and I'm going to say, oh, but it's named larvipartus. Oh, no. larvae. Oh, gosh. I'm going to go with Torkigenor albomaculosis being the fiction because I didn't know that fish build nests. But I like the spots thing. But I'm still going to say that's a fiction.
And Bob.
Oh, Jesus, man. I could have problems for most of these.
That's kind of the
Let's
idea.
Let's see. The, yeah, bastard.
I either want them all to seem perfectly reasonable or all to seem batshit crazy. One or the
yeah.
other.
Yeah. So the brightly colored hairs. Yeah, that doesn't sound quite right. I think male spiders do what they do the little like dance. I guess the movement of colored hairs could be effective. Yeah, the fish thing, a fish making a nest, that's kind of odd. And what kind of a nest is a little circle thing in the seafloor? Oh, damn. The frog one, yeah, I've got a problem with that as well. I mean, so I guess they live there. What's the pre-tadpole stage of life for
an egg?
Yeah, egg.
Okay. So I guess the eggs mature. Yeah, but there's also like some jelly around them too, right?
Yeah.
But it's outside the egg, isn't it? It's like the eggs are embedded in this. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. Whatever. And then the shark one. I mean, what's the advantage for glowing in the dark for a shark? And of course, I love the name Benchley. Peter Benchley wrote Jaws, right? So, but I don't know if that makes it obviously made up by Steve or just scientists being cool. It does not help me. I was like, yeah,
I wish
Benchley.
I knew that. I wish I knew that. But you're right. I don't think it helps at all.
Right. It doesn't help. And that's so frustrating. Benchley, I could just totally see Steve just throwing that in there. Ha ha. They won't remember what Benchley. Maybe I'll get partial credit, even if I don't pick it. No, of course I won't. Why would you glow? Why would a shark glow? That would, and ninja lantern shark? Oh, that just seems so made up. Ninja lantern shark.
Shark scientists are pretty badass.
But sharks, yeah, and sharks, they're some amazing species of sharks. There's the cookie cutter shark that will latch onto subs and like eat the hull. Kara, you picked two, huh? The crop circles?
I picked the crop circles.
Built by the male fish as a nest.
I didn't know that fish had nests.
That's killing me. That I mean, I might need to pick it just for that stupid reason alone.
But then our odds are really bad.
I don't care. I got to go with what, you know, you just got to go with what you think is the jankiest one. I mean, we're going to blow it anyway, Kara. This four, you know, just
know.
Four stupid questions pulled out of his butt that we could, I mean, all the research I did for naught yet again.
Yeah, because these are 2015
right,
species.
I'm going to do a GWC. I'm going to go with Kara. Yeah, the nest, fish, I mean, no. Okay, that's fiction. Better be.
Okay. So let's take this in reverse order.
Okay.
Okay.
So we'll work our way down to the one you guys chose. We'll start with number four, the ninja lantern shark, Etmopterus benchley, is all black but also glows in the dark. You guys both think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, yay! Right. Good. I'm so glad I didn't pick it.
yep, it's
scientists are awesome.
Yes,
the
Benchley was named after the author
of
Jaws.
Is it Peter? Is it Peter Benchley? Is it Peter?
Peter Benchley, author of Jaws. So even though he create a lot of fear about sharks. Later in life, he became a shark conservationist and established the annual Benchley Awards, which recognize achievements in ocean conservation.
Cool.
So lots of lantern sharks, as the name implies, glow in the dark. This is one is the ninja lantern shark because it's also entirely black. They have little special organs or like pockets on their body that will glow in the dark, and they use it to communicate with other sharks, to attract prey. And they also say for camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure how the camouflage thing
works. Yeah, how does that work?
But I guess they're hiding with other glow-in-the-dark stuff.
Yeah. No, I think it's that it's like because most of the things that glow in the dark in the ocean are tiny, like they're food.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like the anglerfish. You know how it almost looks like it's like got bait like coming over its head? But then it goes like, mm-hmm. and like eats anything that goes yeah. after it.
Right. That's the attracting prey part. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But I guess that would also be camouflage, right? Because you're just hiding out. Like you have no idea it's this giant shark because all you see is this tiny right. little pocket. Right, right.
Yeah. So pretty cool. These things live in deep waters off the Pacific coast of Central America. It was discovered by researchers from California. Yeah. Pretty cool. Okay. Let's go on to number three. Limnonectes larvipartis is the only known species out of 6,455 frog species that give birth to live tadpoles. You both think this one is science, and wouldn't it have been convenient if you spoke Latin at this point?
Oh, no.
And this one is science. Yes, it does. It is the only species that gives birth to live tadpoles.
Awesome.
That was the larva thingy, like the... Right?
The larvipartis, yeah. That,
yeah.
That refers to that. Now, there are other species of frogs that don't lay eggs. They give birth to live frogs, but they don't give birth to tadpoles. They give birth to live teeny frogs.
Oh, how cute.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah,
okay.
So they're already frogs, but
that's
they're teeny.
That's a wrinkle.
Yeah, so there's eggs, teeny frogs, and now one frog species that gives birth to live tadpoles.
That's crazy.
Wow.
They said one of the researchers, one of these frogs, squirted out a tadpole into his hand.
Ew.
So it was pretty direct observational evidence.
He must have been like, holy shit.
Holy creepers. Yeah. So pretty cool. All right. There's a lot of new frog species discovered in 2015. Okay. We'll go to number two.
Mm. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
Scientists discovered a fish, Torkogenner albomaculosis, that explains a 20-year-old mystery, the origin of what was dubbed crop circles of the sea, intricate circles built by the male fish as a nest. You guys both think this is fiction because fish don't build nests.
Oh, no.
And this one is
science.
Guys.
So was I right about the spots? Like, albomaculosis sounds like
I don't know.
Oh. It sounds like a bald spot. Not a bald spot, but like a white spot.
I think the fish itself has spots on it, yes. So it builds a nest to lay the eggs, and it's like these concentric circles with ridges. It's actually very beautiful. And the ridges exist in order to protect the eggs from currents of water so they don't get blown away. You know, they don't get swept away by the water. So yeah, it builds a nest for the eggs. So scientists found these circles in the sand in the sea and didn't know what made them for 20 years. They were sea crop circles. But then, they discovered the fish making them in the act of making the circles. The male fish builds a nest for the eggs.
The male fish does have white spots on his back. I'm
the
going with
spots
that
on. Yeah.
I'm going with that.
Yeah, sure. Very cool.
Oh, man. That is really gorgeous. Oh, I'm so annoyed.
Yeah. It's a pretty fish, too. It's very pretty.
Wow. Look at that damn thing. Holy shit.
Yeah, it's pretty, isn't it?
That's mm-hmm. awesome.
Imagine coming upon one of those things on scuba diving.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
And having no idea what it is.
You would think it was man-made. You would think it was like from some sort of equipment.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
It's crazy.
I would actually think there was an object right there.
Yeah.
Right under it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or that an object had been set down there and like pulled up straight. Yeah.
Okay, which means that scientists have named a new species of peacock spider, Meredus jactatus, so named because it extends a semicircle of brightly colored hairs on its back during mating displays. That is the fiction, but there are peacock spiders.
Yeah, do you know why I'm pissed about this? Is because I tweeted about the peacock spider like last week.
The part that's fiction is it does not extend a semicircle of brightly colored hairs, like a peacock.
It just has the brightly colored hairs.
It's just brightly colored, but it doesn't extend like a peacock thing of feathers.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you should feel horrible, Kara.
I know.
They are beautiful little critters, though. I mean,
they are.
The coloring is tremendous.
They're adorable.
There were two species named in 2015. They are adorable. And they move. The way they dance around is incredible, too. You have to see the video of them dancing around. Just look up peacock spider.
I'm watching it right now.
So the two species that were named, one, the common name is Skeletorus, Skeletor. Hmm. And the other one is Sparkle Muffin.
Yes! I love scientists
so much.
That's the Jactatus one, is Sparkle Muffin.
Sparkle Muffin.
Skeletus is Skeletorus. Yeah. Sparkle Muffin.
I was almost certain this one was the science, because not only did I know about the spider, I tweeted about it. I was thinking in my head, I remember when I tweeted that it wasn't new, but it was cool enough and visual enough that I wanted to share the images, because there was a new write-up about it. So I was like, maybe he's trying to get me about that, but he didn't get me. Damn it.
Kara, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
You like Mr. Sparkle?
Oh, boy.
So you like Mr. Sparkle Muffin?
Yep, should have saw that one coming.
Yeah, you should have.
Oh, it's so good.
They are adorable, though. You got to look at
them
online.
They're so cute.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're like, I love their little dance because they do this weird thing with their legs.
It's crazy.
It's crazy looking.
Yeah. All right, guys. That was a challenging one this week. There's four items,
damn
only
it.
Two of you. All right. I have a good quote for this week. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
This one comes from Christopher Hitchens. Always good for a skeptical quote. The essence of the independent mind lies not in what it thinks, but in how it thinks.
Yes.
So good. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a basic thing we talk about a lot, but still it's a great quote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's from Letters to a Young Contrarian. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Sure,
thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.